TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Burning of Books, an extension of the Real History Project. The burning of books creates a powerful symbol. To this day, people kill and die over such an action. Everybody has at least one example in their minds, be it a pastor in Gainesville, Florida, or the burning piles of books in Nazi Germany. In this reading from Michael Parenti's History as Mystery, a book burning stories told that is deeper and maintained for centuries longer than any of these efforts before or after. History shows that burning of books was used to impose a new order and erase all memory. Burnings were directed not only at religious beliefs, but at science, literature, mathematics, astronomy, medicine, and other secular treasures. Parenti explains what he had in mind when he embarked on the Real History Radio project that so far includes the myth of the Founding Fathers, the hidden history of the Spanish-American War, the real causes of World War II, an exploration of fascism and of psychohistory.
Real History is a series of presentations on important and controversial topics, many of which have been shrouded in myth. Most people are never exposed to real history. In school, we usually don't even read history. We read history textbooks, mostly ones that avoid the underlying realities and propagate all sorts of myths that serve the powers that be and are harmful to those who might want to believe in truth and democracy. Those who dominate our vision of the past exercise a preeminent control over how we see the future and the present.
When Parenti's book, History as Mystery, was published by City Lights in San Francisco, Daniel Ellsberg, who made history by disclosing the Pentagon Papers and the real causes of the war on Vietnam, wrote, "Michael Parenti unveils the falsified history from the early Christian church to the present, a fascinating, darkly revelatory tale." Others wrote that Parenti's reading of history demonstrates how past and present can inform each other and how history can be a truly exciting and engaging subject. Here now is today's story of The Burning of Books from History as Mystery by Michael Parenti, disclosing who the biggest purveyor of book burnings of the last 2 millennia was, and how the real perpetrators tried to shift the blame. When this program went to air, Parenti was out of the country. He asked me, Mariah Gilardin, to be the reader. The burning of books, an image likely to come to mind when thinking of the medieval church, is of cloistered monks, the keepers of learning and literacy, toiling with quill pens to produce beautifully lettered manuscripts. Torchison tells us that these monasteries were the bearers of the literary culture of Roman imperial Christianity, preserving the literary wealth of the Roman period. Harold Mattingly sees the church as a bulwark against insurgent barbarism during the dark centuries. Henry Lucas describes the medieval church as the repository of ancient culture, transmitting the literature and learning of antiquity. Philosophy, theology, art, literature, and learning flourished under its protective wing. End quote. The reality is something else. Once the church gained official status under Constantine, there followed what Luciano Canfora describes as the melancholy experience of the war waged by Christianity against the old culture and its sanctuaries, which meant against the libraries. The burning of books was part of the advent and imposition of Christianity. Book burning began rather early as a Christian practice, as recorded in the New Testament, Christian converts in Ephesus responded to Paul's preaching and the name of the Lord Jesus by destroying a large store of books valued at 50,000 pieces of silver. After bestowing legitimate status upon Christianity, Constantine demanded the surrender of heretical works under penalty of death. In 435, Theodosius II and Valentinian III consigned all heretical Nestorian books to the bonfire, and punishment was threatened for those who failed to deliver up Manichaean writings for burning. One chronicler describes a scene in the capital during Justinian's reign that had numerous parallels throughout the empire. Several pagan Greeks were arrested and taken forcibly from place to place, and their books were burned in the Carnegion, and so were the images and statues of their miserable gods. The Carnegion was the site where the corpses of those condemned to death were flung. In 391 in Alexandria, a Christian throng, led by the bishop Theophilus, destroyed a major portion of antiquity's greatest bibliotheca, the Serapeum, the annex or daughter library to the main edifice. The latter was known as the Museum. The Serapeum, wherein was housed the pagan temple of Serapis, contained an irreplaceable trove of scrolls and codices dealing with history, natural science, and literature. Gibbons bemoans this destruction of the Library of Alexandria, and near 20 years afterwards, the appearance of the empty shelves excited the regret and indignation of every spectator whose mind was not totally darkened by religious prejudice. Canfora debunks the widely held misapprehension that Julius Caesar, himself a great supporter of libraries and learning, burned the Library of Alexandria, a myth given renewed currency by George Bernard Shaw's play, Caesar and Cleopatra. The fire that occurred during Caesar's expedition in Alexandria was on the waterfront and nowhere near the library. Documentary evidence shows the library was still flourishing decades after Caesar's expedition to Egypt. In the years after the Serapeum was gutted, the Christians also purged the museum, the main library, so that by the time it was destroyed by Islamic invaders in 641, it housed mostly patristic writings. In pagan times, the Romans had libraries of up to 500,000 volumes. But with Christianity in command, the ancient academies were closed, and in many dioceses, laymen were forbidden to read even the Bible. By the end of the 5th century, the profession of copyist had disappeared, as had the reproduction of most secular writings. The 6 largest monastic libraries in the 6th century contained collections numbering a paltry 200 to 600 volumes, mostly religious in content. The Greeks and Romans had produced a rich literature, but in Christendom, from AD 500 to AD 1100, hardly a book was written that currently wins our attention. Michelet describes the medieval church's scholastic schools as, quote, lighted by the merest glimmer of day through a tiny slit. For hundreds of years between Abelard and Occam, the progress made is zero. The great Greco-Roman tradition of secular learning and education was undone not only by the general decline of Roman civilization, but also by the ideological force of Christianity triumphant. While depicted as an oasis of learning amidst the brutish ignorance of the Dark Ages, the Church actually was a major purveyor of that ignorance, a regressive influence in such fields as literature, philosophy, art, theater, science, medicine, anatomy, astronomy, mathematics, and commerce. Suppressing these subjects entirely or confining them to theological servitude. During the Dark Ages, there were few instances of book burning because there were few books left to burn. The revival of learning and inquiry that came with the growing prosperity of the 11th and 12th centuries, labeled the High Middle Ages by some historians, also brought a revival of the church's bonfires. In 1210, the writings of suspected heretics at the University of Paris, along with works by Aristotle, were torched. In 1229, the Council of Narbonne condemned the possession of any portion of Holy Writ by laypersons. Works by Jaime I of Aragon and William of St. Amour were burned. The forbidden writings of the Albigensians and Waldensians were flung into the flames. In 1239, Pope Gregory IX attempted to cleanse Western Europe of Jewish books, especially the Talmud, which he and his associates incorrectly believed contained blasphemous allusions to the Savior and the Virgin. From the 13th to the early 15th centuries in Paris, Aragon, Castile, Toulouse, and other such places, wagon loads of the Talmud and other purportedly blasphemous Hebrew books were publicly burned. Up until the late 16th century or so, the church hierarchy viewed unbridled literacy among the masses as a threat to religious and social order. Secular learning was perceived as a gateway to heresy. But from the 17th century onward, with a growing dissemination of the printed word, the guiding policy of both Catholic and Protestant churches was not to attempt the impossible task of completely denying access to reading materials, but to control what texts were read and how they were interpreted. The Christian Church of the late antiquity and the Middle Ages also waged war against nature and the flesh, including concerted campaigns against bodily hygiene. The Roman Empire's great public baths were closed. Saints were saluted for having never washed. A naked display of one's body risked mortal sin. Personal ablutions were deemed a kind of defilement, not only in the cloister but also among laypersons. "Never a bath known for 1,000 years," hoots the irrepressible Michelet. No wonder so many of the faithful were afflicted with boils, skin ulcers, and other dermatological torments. Upon becoming the official religion of the empire, the church waged war on the thousands of beautiful edifices that served as pagan sites of worship. Many of these temples were the most splendid and beautiful monuments of Grecian architecture, laments Gibbon. The emperor had an interest to maintain the splendor of his own cities and the value of his possessions. But as long as they stood, and regardless of what neutral use they might be put to, such buildings remained lures for a possible pagan restoration. So during the 380s, throughout the Roman world, an army of Christian fanatics, without authority and without discipline, invaded peaceful pagan precincts and perpetrated the ruin of the fairest structures of antiquity. The goal of the triumphant Jesus worshippers was to convert the whole world to Christianity. The thrust was forward, outward, and global. The expansionist missionary zeal continues into modern times, contributing to the obliteration of the historical memories and cultural heritages of indigenous peoples around the world. As Christianity expanded into distant lands, so did its suppressive mechanisms, including its time-honored practice of book burning. For example, in Mexico in the early 16th century, church authorities, assisted by the swords of conquistadores, denounced all Aztec and Mayan hieroglyphic books as the works of the devil and systematically torched them, so depriving us of invaluable sources of historical data on Mexico's early civilizations. In 1995, a bestseller by Thomas Cahill breathed new life into the myth of the church as a citadel of light and learning. Cahill portrays the monastic clergy as having saved classical civilization from those whom he calls unwashed barbarians, who descended on the Roman cities, looting artifacts and burning books. While the barbarians certainly looted, Cahill offers not a scrap of evidence to support his repeated assertions that they burned books or waged, as the Christians long had been doing, a Kulturkampf against lay literacy and learning. The barbarians seemed little interested one way or another in written texts. The one actual incident Cahill offers of books being damaged by invaders occurred centuries after the fall of Rome in Ireland, when Viking terrorists, as he called them, looted some monasteries and destroyed books by ripping off bejeweled covers for booty. Note, even in this instance, their interest was in the valuable gems, not in the destruction of books as such. Cahill offers the interesting theory that from the last days of the empire until what he calls the rise of medieval Europe, the less rigid and more literate Irish clergy rescued from extinction the classical and ancient folk literature, including Ireland's own rich contributions, and reintroduced such works to Scotland, England, and the continent in the 7th and 8th centuries. Cahill's thesis is not of his own invention. Other historians have noted that Irish monastics produced an impressive flowering of classical learning. They not only preserved Greek and Latin literature, but relished them with true literary enthusiasm. If the Irish thereby saved civilization, it was not from the barbarians, but from their fellow ecclesiastics on the continent. Actually, there were places, in addition to the Irish monasteries, in which literature and learning were preserved and even advanced. In the private manors of some few learned aristocrats, in the cities of the Byzantine Empire of southeastern Europe, among the Moors of northern Africa and Spain, and in other locales peripheral to Christendom. But Cahill's book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, would have had far less sales appeal had he more accurately entitled it, How the Irish Played a Limited but Valuable Role, along with others, in preserving a portion of what might be called civilization. Cahill offers not a word about the closing of academies, the destruction of libraries, the banning of books, and the overall intellectual repression waged by the Christian Church well before the fall of Rome and continuing long afterward. From about 320 to 395, the 28 public libraries in Rome, like tombs, were closed forever, as he quotes the lamenting Ammianus Marcellinus, whom he fails to identify as a pagan and a noted 4th century historian. Again, the impression left is that the barbarians were to blame, but the closings occurred during the time of Christian domination, years before the barbarians sacked Rome in 410. Cahill does drop a few hints regarding Christianity's war against learning, mentioning Pope Gregory's hostility toward pagan classics, and St. Jerome's fear of damnation for having read Cicero. Ironically, the one actual case Cahill gives of book burning is by a pope, Honorius III's order in 1225 to torch all copies of a metaphysical work of some originality by Irish philosopher John Scotus Eriugena. Along with the closing of academies came the closing of minds. There was no limit to the enmity that leading churchmen felt towards secular arts and learning. The church fathers despised all knowledge that was not useful to salvation, along with every earthly and corporal delight, including the enjoyment of music, art, and literature. Early in the 3rd century, Tertullian related how, in the next life, he would laugh and exult when he beheld the proud monarchs, sage philosophers, deluded scholars, celebrated poets, tragedians, dancers, and others all groaning in the abyss and burning in the eternal flames. With equal vehemence, Augustine disdains the so-called liberal arts that occupied his earlier years, when he was the vile slave of vile affections. Secular learning was worse than superfluous, it was pernicious. His studies in rhetoric, logic, music, geometry, and arithmetic had led him not to God, but to his own perdition. But now, as a Christian, he felt he could spend a lifetime studying only the scriptures, yet not fully plumb their rich mysteries. Before we blame the barbarians for destroying classical civilization, we might question whether the term civilization and barbarian convey an accurate impression of the respective cultural levels of contending forces in the 5th century. In the mind of the modern reader, civilization probably suggests a higher degree of social development and literacy than was actually enjoyed in 5th century Christendom, and barbarian conjures up images of hairy brutes in animal skins. In fact, the northern people had a level of civil organization, folk culture, agriculture, and military technology that in many respects was the same or not much less advanced than what existed to the south. In the 1st century BC, long before the sacking of Rome, Gaul was more extensive in area, more populous, richer in resources, and only slightly less advanced technologically than Italy. Something of the same might be said of Germany. On various occasions during the early centuries of the Christian era, contingents of Germans and other northerners were allowed to settle within the empire and even join the Roman army. Many of these German officers were men of brilliant talents, fascinating address, and noble bearing. Another familiar but misleading image is of Rome being sacked and the empire being overturned by a horde of marauding barbarians. In 410, the Visigoths, led by King Alaric, entered the city in an attempt to force the emperor to accept their demands for a homeland. Many Roman commoners, demoralized by heavy taxes, corruption, and despotism of the late empire, were either indifferent to the invaders or actually welcomed them. Roman servants and slaves joined in the looting of wealthy residences and the killing that ensued. On orders from Alaric, the invaders did little damage to churches, public buildings, and the city in general. After 6 days, the Visigoths departed. They may have sacked Rome, but they hardly brought down Roman civilization. Even with the subsequent takeover of Roman territory and the appearance of Germanic tribes along much of the Mediterranean shore, as Henri Pirenne notes, the northern tribes thought to settle themselves in those happy regions where the mildness of the climate and the fertility of the soil were matched by the charms and the wealth of civilization. Their aim was not to disassemble the Roman Empire, but to occupy and enjoy it. What they preserved far exceeded what they destroyed, or introduced anew. To be sure, from the 6th to the 10th centuries, successive invasions by Slavs, Bulgars, and Magyars from the east, piratical Scandinavians from the north, and Saracens from the south had a seriously disruptive effect on Greco-Roman society and commerce. The point to remember, however, is that much of the civic impoverishment was effected before these invasions and must be credited to the narrowly spirited Christian orthodoxy that strove without stint for monopoly control over all cultural and intellectual output. While a Christianized Western and Central Europe slumped into the Dark Ages, there was no comparable devolution in the Byzantine Empire of Southeast Europe, and there was an extraordinary intellectual burgeoning throughout much of the Arabic world. In sum, contrary to the conventional wisdom, we should spend less time blaming the barbarians and more time scrutinizing the role played by Christianity in ushering in a stagnation that lasted for the better part of a millennium. That was a reading of The Burning of Books by Michael Parenti from History as Mystery, published in 1999 by City Lights in San Francisco. History as Mystery contains many more intriguing chapters, from the Inquisition and Joan of Arc to the way present-day textbooks distort labor history. Michael Parenti is among our leading progressive political analysts. He received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962 and has taught at colleges in the U.S. and abroad. The focus of his lectures is American democracy, U.S. foreign policy, and the invented reality of the media. He is the author of over 20 books, among them God and His Demons, Contrary Notions, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. His most recent book, The Face of Imperialism, came out in April 2011. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.